Royal City Uke Fest is thrilled to welcome James Hill and Anne Janelle to their evening stage performance on Saturday, September 30th at Dublin Street United Church. Together, they have toured in over 15 countries and conjure a sound that is intricate, enchanting, and engaging. And the day before, Royal City Uke Fest will be hosting a ukulele strum-along. Come to this free event at the Red Papaya in the Old Quebec Street Mall on Friday, September 29th at 7:30 p.m. Both of these events are physically accessible. For more info and to purchase tickets, please visit royalcityukefest.com.
If you desire to discover and observe the unique terrain of progressive rock and other eclectic genres of alternate music, then gaze into the SMK, the Sentinel's marvelous kaleidoscope. Guided by yours truly, Nicholas Cooper, SMK airs weekly on Mondays from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. at CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, Ontario, and through the web at cfru.ca. Check out, keep up, and connect on SMK's Facebook page at SMK Radio Program. Behold the Sentinel's marvelous kaleidoscope on Monday starting at 3 p.m. so together we can prog on and look inward and beyond.
This week, the Bookshelf Cinema is screening The Beguiled, All Eyes on Me, Monterey Pop, Moulin Rouge, Paris Can Wait, and The Journey. And at the E-Bar on the 26th is Kazoo number 259, Homeshake and Guy's Number. On the 28th is Electric Circus Night with DJ Madam D. And on the 29th is That's My Drag, The Glamorous Life, a four-year anniversary. The Bookshelf is an independently owned bookstore, bar, music venue, movie theater, and restaurant located at 41 Quebec Street. For more info about the Bookshelf's hours, listings, blogs, directions, accessibility, and to order books from their online store from anywhere in the world, please visit bookshelf.ca.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Sergeant at Arms will restore order in the chamber.
Protesters shouted, "Kill the bill and shame." Senate Republicans voted Tuesday to open debate on repealing Obamacare. The health care of tens of millions of people is at stake. It comes as President Trump intensifies his attacks on his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions.
I am disappointed in the Attorney General. He should not have recused himself. Almost immediately after he took office.
We'll speak with Joshua Green of Bloomberg Businessweek about the latest news, plus his new book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the storming of the presidency.
I think the book really gives an insight into Steve Bannon and Donald Trump, who they are, what they came together to do, and really explains why things have gone off the rails in the early months of the Trump administration.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Senate Republicans narrowly pushed through a procedural vote to open debate on plans to repeal and maybe replace the Affordable Care Act Tuesday, but then suffered a defeat only hours later when Republicans failed to muster enough votes to pass their replacement bill. First on Tuesday, the Senate voted 50-50 to open the debate, with Vice President Mike Pence then breaking the tie. Two Republican senators, both women, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, joined Democrats in voting against the motion to proceed. Arizona Senator John McCain dramatically returned to Capitol Hill to cast a decisive vote to open debate only a week after being diagnosed with brain cancer. But once the debate began, divisions within the Republican Party over a replacement bill doomed their efforts to push through any legislation. 9 Republicans joined Democrats in rejecting the first health care proposal, which would cause more than 20 million people to lose their health insurance in the next 10 years. The Republicans needed 60 votes to pass the bill, but ultimately received only 43. Throughout the day, Republican lawmakers faced massive protests in the Senate chamber, at offices, across Capitol Hill, and even on the doorsteps of their own homes. Nearly 100 people were arrested throughout the day. This is one activist speaking during an early morning protest outside Ohio Senator Rob Portman's home.
Her name is Charlie.
Her name is Charlie.
She was born at 26 weeks.
She was born at 26 weeks.
She weighed 1 pound 12 ounces.
She weighed 1 pound 12 ounces.
The ACA gave her a chance.
The ACA gave her a chance.
Medicaid made this possible.
Medicaid made this possible.
A yes will steal her future.
A yes will steal her future.
She is my daughter.
She is my daughter.
And I will fight.
And I will fight.
Until we win.
Until we win.
She's speaking as her daughter Charlie sits on her shoulders, holding a sign reading, "Her birth is a pre-existing condition." Hours later, hundreds of activists with the disability rights group ADAPT occupied the Hart Senate building, chanting, "I'd rather go to jail than die without Medicaid."
I'd rather go to jail than die without Medicaid. I'd rather go to jail than die without Medicaid.
At least 64 activists with ADAPT were arrested, many of them in wheelchairs. Faith leaders also held a rally and mock funeral march for the thousands who could die without insurance if Republicans repeal the Affordable Care Act. This is Tracy Blackman, Executive Minister of Justice and Witness Ministries for the United Church of Christ.
I am coming here today from the bedside of a dear friend's sick daughter, who would not likely still be among us if it were not for the Affordable Care Act. Yeah. I am black and she is white, but that doesn't matter because the need for health care transcends skin tone. She is Jewish and I am Christian, but that doesn't matter because the need for health care transcends religious beliefs. I was able to be at her bedside because the ACA guaranteed that a heart transplant did not prevent her from maintaining coverage because of lifetime limits.
Then around 2:30 p.m. Tuesday, a Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell asked for a vote to proceed to a debate on the health care bill. 19 activists were arrested in the Senate chamber as they shouted, "Kill the bill! Kill the bill!
Kill the bill! Don't kill us! Kill the bill! Don't kill us!"
Sergeant at Arms will restore order in the chamber.
Reporters say they were ordered by Capitol Police to delete photos and videos of the arrests of the activists from their phones. Senate lawmakers will resume debating and voting on the health care bill today. President Trump is continuing to publicly humiliate his own attorney general, Jeff Sessions, telling reporters Tuesday he thinks it's unfair Sessions recused himself from the investigation into alleged Russian meddling in the 2016 election.
I am disappointed in the attorney general. He should not have recused himself almost immediately after he took office. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me prior to taking office, and I would have quite simply picked somebody else. So I think that's a bad thing, not for the president, but for the presidency. I think it's unfair to the presidency. And that's the way I feel. Thank you.
Trump's comments Tuesday are the latest in a string of intensifying attacks against Sessions. The Washington Post has reported Trump and his advisors are considering replacing Sessions and that Texas Senator Ted Cruz and former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani are among the candidates being considered as Sessions' replacement. Meanwhile, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has intensified his attack against sanctuary cities, saying Tuesday the Justice Department will refuse refuse to give cities hundreds of millions of dollars in federal grants unless they agree to cooperate with the federal government's crackdown against undocumented immigrants, saying states must allow federal immigration authorities to operate inside state jails and alert ICE agents when someone who's undocumented is set to be released if cities want to receive the federal grants. In more news from Capitol Hill, President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, will not testify today before the Senate Judiciary Committee after the panel dropped the subpoena. This comes after Manafort met with Senate investigators Tuesday to answer questions about his meeting, along with Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., last summer with a Kremlin-linked lawyer promising damaging information on Hillary Clinton. Jared Kushner also testified during a closed-door session with the House Intelligence Committee for about 3 hours on Tuesday. Meanwhile, in a direct challenge to President Trump, the House of Representatives voted 419-3 Tuesday to give Congress the power to block any effort by the White House to weaken U.S. sanctions against Russia. This is Democratic Rhode Island Congressman David Cicilline.
And we simply cannot allow any foreign power to interfere in our electoral process. Given our president's complete unwillingness to hold Russia accountable for their attack, and let's not mistake it for anything else, it was an attack on America. It has become necessary for Congress to assert its role in this area and ensure that Russia will be held accountable.
President Trump intensified his threats against Iran during a speech in Youngstown, Ohio on Tuesday.
The Iran deal, which may be the single worst deal I've ever seen drawn by anybody, if that deal doesn't conform to what it's supposed to conform to, there's going to be big, big problems for them. That I can tell you. You're going to see that.
These threats come despite the fact that the Trump administration begrudgingly certified that Iran has complied with its obligations under the Obama-brokered nuclear agreement last week. The State Department has also announced new sanctions against Iran over alleged support for terrorism and Iran's ballistic missile program. During Trump's same speech Tuesday in Youngstown, he also repeated his frequent attacks on the news media and claimed he can be more presidential than any president in history, except Abraham Lincoln.
And I said, with the exception of the late, great Abraham Lincoln, I can be more presidential than any president that's ever held this office.
Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Democratic Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island were caught on a hot mic expressing concern that President Trump is crazy. They were speaking at the end of a Senate subcommittee hearing on Tuesday. This is Senator Reed.
This is crazy. I don't say that lightly and as a kind of busy guy.
And that was Senator Collins saying she's worried. Earlier this month, more than 20 Democratic lawmakers expressed support for a bill introduced by Maryland Congressmember Jamie Raskin that would create a commission to determine if the president is mentally or physically unfit for office. Palestinians have vowed to continue protesting the new Israeli security measures being imposed at the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, saying the new proposal to install surveillance cameras is just as bad as the metal detectors Israel installed earlier this month, sparking massive protests. Palestinian activist Mohammed Abu Ahamas said, quote, "Above all else, this is an issue of control and power. I want to go in and out of the Al-Aqsa as I please. Who are they to surveil me?" he asked. Israel was forced to remove the metal detectors after widespread protests and violence, which killed 7 people, 4 Palestinians and 3 Israelis. Israeli troops have also injured more than 1,000 Palestinian protesters by shooting them with live fire, rubber-coated steel bullets, tear gas and stun grenades. Amnesty International says heavily armed Israeli troops also raided a Palestinian hospital twice during the protest on July 17th and July 20th. 21st, harassing the staff and chasing wounded protesters who were trying to receive treatment after being attacked by the soldiers. The hospital's head of reception, Talal al-Sayed, said, quote, "They invaded the entire hospital. They even entered the neonatal unit. What do they want in there? It was pure terrorization of the patients," unquote. In Afghanistan, at least 26 Afghan soldiers have been killed in a Taliban attack on a military base in Kandahar province on Tuesday. The defense ministry says 13 more soldiers were wounded. At least 7 people were kidnapped in the attack. Meanwhile, the Afghan Journalist Safety Committee says at least 10 journalists have been killed in Afghanistan so far this year. The group says the Taliban and ISIS militants are responsible for the majority of the attacks against media workers in Afghanistan. In Syria, U.S.-led coalition airstrikes and shelling by U.S.-backed troops reportedly killed at least 18 civilians in the city of Raqqa Tuesday. That's according to the local journalistic group Raqqa is being slaughtered silently, which says the U.S.-led coalition launched more than 40 airstrikes over the last 2 days as part of the ongoing campaign to seize control of Raqqa from ISIS. In the Philippines, human rights groups are denouncing President Rodrigo Duterte after he threatened to bomb indigenous schools, claiming they were teaching children to be communists and anti-government rebels. In a speech on Monday, Duterte said, quote, "I'm telling the LUMADs now," in reference to an indigenous group in the southern Philippines, "I will use the armed forces, the Philippine Air Force. I'll really have those bombed because you're operating illegally and you're teaching the children to rebel against government," he said. And in Chile, hundreds of people took to the streets Tuesday to demand abortion be legalized, only days after a bill to increase abortion access failed to pass by only one vote. The bill would have allowed abortion in the case of rape, if a mother's life is at risk, or if the fetus has a deadly birth defect. More than 70% of Chileans supported the legislation, and some support legalizing abortion in any cases. This is one of the protesters Tuesday.
"An abortion where everybody has the right to an abortion and not obligatory motherhood. We don't want 3 causes. We want an infinite number of causes because women have the right to make a decision on their body."
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Tuesday was another dramatic day in Washington. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans voted by the narrowest of margins to open debate on repealing Obamacare. Vice President Mike Pence broke a 50-50 tie in the Senate. 2 Republican senators, both women, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, joined Democrats in voting against the motion to proceed. Republican Senator John McCain made a dramatic entrance and cast a decisive vote to open debate after flying in from Arizona, where he's being treated for brain cancer. But hours later, the effort to repeal or replace Obamacare faced another setback when 9 Republicans joined Democrats in rejecting the first health care proposal. Meanwhile, President Trump continued to publicly humiliate his own Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who was the first senator to endorse Trump during the 2016 race. On Twitter, Trump described Sessions as beleaguered and very weak. Then, at a news conference in the Rose Garden, Trump told reporters Sessions shouldn't have recused himself from the probe into alleged Russian meddling in the 2016 election.
"I am disappointed in the Attorney General. He should not have recused himself almost immediately after he took office. And if he was going to recuse himself, he should have told me prior to taking office, and I would have quite simply picked somebody else. So I think that's a bad thing, not for the president, but for the presidency. I think it's unfair to the presidency, and that's the way I feel. Thank you."
To talk more about these latest developments, we're joined by Joshua Green, senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek, author of the new book, which we're going to spend the hour talking about today, Devil's Bargain: Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the storming of the presidency. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Josh.
Great to be here. Thanks.
It's great to have you with us. So a lot happened yesterday on a number of fronts. Yes, President Trump continued his attack on his attorney general, Jeff Sessions. And in the narrowest of votes, the Senate voted to move ahead in repealing and, I don't know, possibly replacing Obamacare, right? 50-50, 2 senators, both women, joining the 2 Republican senators joining the Democrats, voting against opening debate. But ultimately, Vice President Pence broke the tie, and they are moving forward today. The significance of all of this.
Well, it's significant that they moved forward. In Congress, it's called a motion to proceed. And this is just to begin the debate. This is what happened yesterday. And there was real fear in the White House and among Republicans that they wouldn't even get that far, that sort of this is the stage that health care might die on. But as we saw, McCain came back. He provided the 50th vote. Pence was the tie-breaking vote. Then they could move forward. But I think the real signal yesterday about how things are going came when they voted on this deeply unpopular Republican Senate bill and had 9 defections. That's a very bad sign for Republicans who support repeal and some kind of replacement. It doesn't get any easier going forward. And so there's going to be debate. There's going to be what's called a votorama, where different amendments are voted on. But the kind of last gasp hope for Republicans is they might be able to pass a scaled-back version of repeal known as a skinny bill that only takes away some of these benefits, but less than what they'd like to take away.
Many commenting online and social media. Here was John McCain coming back, very moving as he hugged Democrat and Republican colleagues, but then ultimately voting to open the debate. Not that he said he would necessarily support what was going to be presented next, but coming back from his own surgery, what most people in America could not have afforded if they didn't have health care.
You know, there's something striking about this, because I was in Washington reporting on health care back during the Obamacare fight when Ted Kennedy, who had the same brain cancer that John McCain has now, flew back in clearly weakened to cast the deciding vote to give people health care. And here McCain is, and he comes in and gives this dramatic speech about how Republicans need to return to regular order, which they've ignored throughout this process, and casts the deciding vote to go ahead and take health care away from people. It was a dramatic bookend, and I think it just shows how extreme even Republicans like John McCain, who has always been considered kind of a populist maverick, someone who flirted with switching parties and becoming a Democrat 10, 15 years ago, how far out on the rightward fringe they've gotten.
And also how interesting it is when people ask what difference would it make if the women actually had parity in the Senate, that it's two women senators, a Republican, who joined with the Democrats.
I think that's right, because there are all sorts of things in the bill. I mean, I know Susan Collins of Maine, one of the women senators, had said, you know, she objects to the fact that the bill would defund Planned Parenthood, and that was a deal killer for her. There aren't any men among the Republican Senate caucus that feel the same way. So it's so important, the individual politics of the senators, but you can also see the importance of individual Senate races. Had Democrats won an additional seat last year, this motion to proceed on health care wouldn't have happened. So it gives you, it's a reminder of just how vital every election is when it comes to these big landmark bills.
And speaking of Planned Parenthood, the Senate parliamentarian ruling that Planned Parenthood could not be defunded for a year with just a majority vote. And then the Senate majority leader saying that he might overrule what she said.
Exactly. I mean, this is another steamrolling of congressional and constitutional norms. And we've seen this a lot over the last 6 months. And it tends to be attributed mainly to President Trump, because he is so offensive and transgressive and kind of crashes through these norms. But the real story here, it seems to me, is that mainstream Republicans like Mitch McConnell are doing the same thing and going even further, having no open hearings on this landmark bill, not following the normal rules of procedure. And now when you have a Senate parliamentarian saying, no, what you're trying to do is against the rules, they're saying, all right, well, we're just going to erase the rules and go ahead and do it anyway. There's something really dangerous about that.
And at the same time, you have Donald Trump attempting, clearly, to push out, a little nervous about probably firing the attorney general, given all the controversies of the past, but trying to put enough pressure on him, calling him weak and beleaguered, to get him out as attorney general.
I don't think that's right. I don't think he's actually trying to get him out as attorney general. I think he's trying to humiliate him publicly and at great length. But at the very beginning of this process, when Trump first started criticizing him publicly, Sessions went and offered his resignation. So if Trump wanted him out, he'd be gone.
At the time.
At the time.
We're talking 4 months ago.
But he still has a resignation letter from Jeff Sessions. I mean, Sessions didn't leave his office and take that letter with him. If Trump wanted him out, he would be out. And I've talked to people in the White House around Trump who are very concerned about this, but they say Sessions doesn't want to leave and Trump isn't inclined to fire him. So the lesson you learn in Donald Trump's White House, and Steve Bannon has had to endure this, now it's Jeff Sessions' turn, is that you're going to be humiliated. Your integrity is going to be questioned. But if you're willing to just sit there and endure it, you can probably survive.
And his point, what's Trump trying to do in humiliating him?
I think assert his dominance and just express his anger. One White House advisor texted yesterday. I said, what is the Sessions all about? What's the end game? And he said, well, Trump is just blowing off steam. He's angry about the Russia investigation. Every time there's some new iteration, and yesterday it was his son-in-law testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Every time there's some new iteration, he gets angry. And he remembers that if Jeff Sessions hadn't recused himself, or so Trump thinks, none of this would be happening. And so he goes out and humiliates him all over again.
So you don't buy the idea that he wants him out, will appoint a recess appointment to be attorney general who could then fire the special counsel,
I mean,
Mueller.
You never want to make predictions about Donald Trump, because he could wake up and see something that enrages him on Fox and Friends, and boom, you know, Sessions is out of there. But at least so far, among the people that I've talked to around Trump, no, he doesn't seem, for whatever reason, to try and force Sessions all the way out.
Meanwhile, Sessions is clearly forging forward, and just in our headlines today, intensifying his attack on sanctuary cities, pushing through this rule that cities around the country would not be able to get something like $250 million in aid if they don't cooperate with ICE and allow them to go into the jails, tell them when an undocumented immigrant has been held.
Exactly. I mean, one of the twisted ironies of this whole situation, and the reason that you see the right-wing base aghast over this. Ann Coulter was in the White House a couple days ago. Breitbart News and Tucker Carlson and Fox News have all been very critical of Trump on this. It's because Jeff Sessions is the one person in Trump's cabinet who's actually managing to carry out some of his agenda, right? His legislative agenda, for the most part, is pancaking. He's not getting anywhere. But Sessions is the most powerful law enforcement official in the land and can do a lot of things in terms of criminal justice and especially in terms of immigration crackdown without having to go through Congress. And so what you see is not only are arrests of undocumented immigrants way, way up under Trump, you have the threatening statement to sanctuary cities. Jeff Sessions is also the guy who is sending new administrative judges to the U.S.-Mexico border so that they can process deportations even faster. He's doing what it is that Trump says he wants done and railed about in his speech in Youngstown last night, and yet the one guy who's tearing out Trump's agenda is also being ritually humiliated during the process. It's twisted.
So, Josh, you mentioned Breitbart News. And in the next two segments, we're going to go deeply into the man who used to be the head of it, Steve Bannon. But Breitbart News leading the charge right now to try to protect the attorney general, with Steve Bannon inside the White House doing that.
I don't think he needs to. Breitbart News has been aligned with Jeff Sessions and his former senior staffer, now White House senior staffer Stephen Miller, since 2013, 2014. Back then, Jeff Sessions was the most anti-immigrant hardliner in Congress, so much so that during the 2013 debate over bipartisan immigration reform, there were amendments offered that were so extreme that Jeff Sessions was the lone vote in the Senate to vote for them. Too extreme, even for hardliners like Ted Cruz. So there's a real agreement between Breitbart and Bannon and Jeff Sessions and his staff about how to approach issues like immigration and criminal justice reform. The fact that that Sessions is being punished in the way that he is deeply upsetting to the whole right-wing populist base, because Sessions is the avatar and the implementer of everything that they really believe in. And so it's almost like seeing two of your parents fighting. You know, Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions are the politicians that these people admire, and now one of them is hitting the other and threatening to fire him from the most powerful law enforcement position in the land.
His great advocates in the White House, Steve Bannon and Steve Miller, as you said. Steve Miller, who was Jeff Sessions' staffer before he joined Donald Trump on the campaign trail, mm-hmm. Warming up speeches before Trump with fiercely anti-immigrant speeches, now inside the White House with Steve Bannon.
Well, the speech in Youngstown last night, which was just macabre and bizarre, where Trump is talking about young teenage girls being slashed with knives by marauding illegal immigrants. I mean, it's like a scene out of a horror movie. That is all Stephen Miller. And I actually interviewed Stephen Miller in February, and I said, why is it that the speeches you write for Trump are so dark and disturbing? And he said, well, you in the mainstream media, meaning me, refuse to report on the crimes committed by undocumented immigrants because you secretly support them. And therefore, we need to heighten the contradictions and make it even more vivid. And nowhere is this more vivid than in speeches like the one that Trump gave last night. Mm.
And then you have Breitbart News headline yesterday across the homepage, Trump versus Trump, POTUS endangers immigration agenda.
And that's absolutely right, because Jeff Sessions is the one, A, who believes what Trump professes to believe and believes what Breitbart's editorial staff believes ought to be done about immigration. And here he is, not just being humiliated, but being threatened with firing. And if Sessions were to leave, it is impossible for me to imagine a replacement who could be as hawkish and as severe on immigration as Jeff Sessions is. So by definition, if he were to leave, whoever his replacement wound up being, some Fox News TV judge or Lord knows who Trump would appoint, that person would be weaker on immigration than Jeff Sessions is from the standpoint of a Breitbart reader.
We're talking to Josh Green, and we're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about his book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the storming of the presidency. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Excuse me, I'm not the man I used to be. Someone else crept in again. I wanna be alone.
Excuse me, Peter Gabriel, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to look at the man many credit with helping Donald Trump become president, Steve Bannon, the former head of Breitbart News. During the early days of the Trump presidency, many suggested Bannon, Trump's chief strategist, was pulling many of the strings in the Oval Office. Time magazine put Bannon on its cover in February with the headline, The Great Manipulator. That same month, Bannon, in a rare public comment, outlined his plans for the Trump administration.
I think if you look at the lines of work, I kind of break it out into three verticals or three buckets. The first is kind of national security and sovereignty, and that's your intelligence, the Defense Right. Department, Homeland Security. The second line of work is what I refer to as economic nationalism. The third, broadly, line of work is what is deconstruction of the administrative state. If you look at these cabinet appointees, they were selected for a reason, and that is the deconstruction. The way the progressive left runs is if they can't get it passed, they're just going to put it in some sort of regulation in an agency. That's all going to be deconstructed, and I think that that's why this regulatory thing is so important.
We had Dr.
That was Steve Bannon speaking at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. Well, a new book by our guest Joshua Green chronicles how Bannon took his hard-right nationalist politics from the fringes of the Republican Party all the way to the White House. Green has been closely following Bannon's career for years. In October 2015, before Bannon joined Trump's campaign, Green dubbed Bannon the most dangerous political operative in America. At the time, Bannon was head of Breitbart News and overseeing a multifaceted campaign to take down Hillary Clinton, as well as more moderate Republican candidates. Joshua Green's new book is titled Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. So, Josh, talk about the rise of Donald Trump and why you think Steve Bannon was so key. Perhaps if there hadn't been a Steve Bannon, there wouldn't be a president Donald Trump.
That's my contention in the book. And I think that the best way to understand this election, to understand what happened and how a guy like Trump wound up in the White House, and really to understand the forces that are roiling our politics and producing such extreme and unusual things as we see literally every day now in the Trump administration. To understand that, you have to understand Steve Bannon. To me, he is the narrative thread that runs through not just the rise of Trump, but the rise of this whole right-wing populist nationalist politics that he has been espousing ever since I first met him in 2011. And the story I tell in the book basically is the intertwined story of the rise of Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. But Bannon, I met back in 2011 when he was working on a documentary film about Sarah Palin, who he hoped would run for president in 2012. And he was trying to fill her head with the same ideas and the same policies that you heard from Donald Trump. It took him a while to find his candidate. But he was brought into Trump's orbit in 2010. He began advising him, kind of tutoring him on politics informally at a time when everybody else, and certainly I, didn't take Trump seriously as a politician. I thought he was going to goose his ratings. But Bannon was able to take his nationalist politics, and in particular, the idea that there is political power and taking a hard line on immigration, on demonizing immigrants as marauders and killers, that Trump seemed to have intuitively sensed would resonate among Republican grassroots voters. And the combination of birtherism, which Trump pioneered on his own, and this anti-immigrant sentiment kind of mixed together to produce the candidate who upset the entire Republican field.
Talk about how Bannon came into Trump's orbit, not originally, but in the summer of 2016, how he came to take over. And this, of course, is also the story of the Mercers.
Yeah, sure. Well, Bannon had been this kind of minor figure in Trump's life since 2010, when a veteran anti-Clinton activist named David Bossie brought him along on a trip to Trump Tower just to tutor Trump about politics. But he didn't enter most people's political awareness until he took over the campaign dramatically in mid-August of 2016, at a time when Trump looked like he was floundering and almost certainly headed toward a blowout loss. And I have a scene in the book that begins with the daughter of a right-wing, very secretive right-wing billionaire named Robert Mercer, who is the co-CEO of Renaissance Technologies, fabulously successful hedge fund.
That's based out in Stony Brook, Long Island.
That's based out in Stony Brook, Long Island. Mercer and his daughter, I call them in the book kind of the alt Koch brothers. You know, the Koch brothers tend to be more mainstream. The Mercers have much more unusual and different beliefs. And they are essentially, or have been, Steve Bannon's benefactors over the last couple of years, pouring money into Breitbart News, but also into a movie production company, Cambridge Analytica, a data sciences firm that Trump relied on, and most importantly, a nonprofit research entity down in Tallahassee, Florida, called the Government Accountability Institute, which produced the Clinton Cash book that came out on the eve of the election and sort of tarnished Hillary Clinton's image by documenting her ties to some of these shady foreign donors. Well, the Mercers were big backers of Trump. They were originally behind Cruz, but once he fell, they got behind Trump right away in a way that a lot of other wealthy Republicans were loath to do, giving him money, setting up a super PAC. But Rebecca Mercer, the daughter, who is very aggressive in getting involved in the candidates and causes she backs, I have a scene in the book where she flies out to a Trump fundraiser in Long Island, demands a meeting with Trump, and you can do that if you've given him millions and millions of dollars, as the Mercers have, and says, look, you're losing. You're going to lose this election unless you make a change. And Trump says, well, yeah, things aren't going real well, but, and she says, no, you're losing, and the only way you're going to win is you have a radical change. I have a team of people that I think ought to take over your campaign, Steve Bannon, Kellyanne Conway, and later David Bossie, all of them veteran Clinton activists. And Trump, who was frustrated with his current campaign manager, Paul Manafort, agrees and says, okay, let's put him in charge. We need somebody who can hit harder. Bannon is this famously aggressive Breitbart News publisher who would not be held back, has the same instincts as Trump. And people didn't know it at the time, but Trump had known Bannon for a long time. And lo and behold, we wake up, I think, on a Wednesday morning to this announcement that Steve Bannon, despised by just about everybody in Washington, is now in charge of Trump's presidential campaign.
And Paul Manafort is out, something he was resisting, and Jared Kushner played a role in that.
Well, it's funny. Paul Manafort wasn't out originally, and what Trump did was he hired Bannon, I think, on a Sunday night without telling Paul Manafort or anybody else. And there's a scene in the book where it's on a Sunday, and Trump tells Bannon, okay, you're in. Drive out to my country club in Bedminster, New Jersey tomorrow. We're going to have a senior staff meeting with Giuliani and Chris Christie and Manafort and all the kind of campaign brain trust. Kushner actually wasn't there because he was off yachting in Croatia with David Geffen. So he wasn't present for that meeting. But at the meeting, Manafort, who still thinks he's in charge of the campaign, walks into a room and sees Steve Bannon there. And Bannon says, hey, I'm kind of joining the campaign. And Trump is in a very bad mood because the New York Times has just run this embarrassing story saying that Trump's own advisors feel they can't talk to him. And so they have to go on cable news in order to send the message to Trump. And Trump, who's been made to look like a fool, explodes at Manafort. There's a scene I have in the book where he says, you know, am I a baby, Paul? Do you treat me like a baby? You have to go on TV and curses him in language we probably can't use on the air here. A couple days later, decides that Manafort has to go. But Trump, despite the public image, doesn't like to fire people. So he deputizes his son-in-law back from his yachting trip with David Geffen at a breakfast to get rid of Manafort, who resists.
And he says, you're going to make it look like I'm guilty on the Russia stuff.
Exactly. He doesn't want to do it because it'll look like he's guilty of taking money from this pro-Russian Ukrainian political party. And he resists. And Kushner says, basically, you're going. We have a press release coming out saying that you've resigned, and that goes online at 9 a.m., and that's in 30 seconds. And that was the end of Paul Manafort and the beginning of the successful Steve Bannon era of the campaign.
So let's talk about Steve Bannon and his background, where he comes from, for people to understand the different forces at play.
Well, so the newspaper bio synopsis of Steve Bannon is that he comes from a blue-collar Irish Democratic Catholic Navy family in Richmond, Virginia. Dad is a telephone linesman and went to Virginia Tech, got into Harvard Business School, was in the Navy, later Goldman Sachs, and wound up in Hollywood first as a film financier and investment banker. And later, once he'd made some money, he moved over to the creative side and began making conservative documentaries about the
when you say made some money, we're talking Seinfeld.
We're talking Seinfeld, yes. So the interesting, weird little detail in Bannon's life is that while he was an investment banker, he brokered a deal between Castle Rock Pictures, which owned Seinfeld, which was in its infancy at the time, and Ted Turner, who wanted to buy the shows. And as Bannon tells me the story in the book, you know, when they sat down at the table, Turner was short of cash. And so rather than let the deal fall apart, Bannon took, in lieu of his ordinary advisory fee, he took a basket of residuals from five television shows, including Seinfeld. As we all know, Seinfeld went on to become, I think, what the most popular sitcom in television history, and throw off an awful lot of money. Bannon and his partner own a very small part of that, but enough that they've made millions and millions of dollars from it. So once Bannon got to that point, he decided he wanted to give a kind of a full airing to his hard right conservative politics, which I think he'd kept hidden as he traveled through the worlds of Harvard and Goldman Sachs and Hollywood.
Goldman Sachs, his hero, Michael Milken.
That's true. Bannon was at Goldman Sachs as an investment banker in the mid-1980s at the height of the leverage takeover boom. If you've ever read Barbarians at the Gate or some of these books, you know that there were these outsiders who were kind of storming the fortress and taking over sort of fattened corporations that were vulnerable to these outsiders. Bannon, I think, to his frustration, worked for Goldman Sachs, which would never align itself with the corporate raiders. It always did defense. But he recognized in Michael Milken, a guy who was kind of his spirit animal. Here's an outsider, you know, storming the fortresses, and he's winning. And these establishment banks, like the ones that I'm working for, really don't get it, and they're losing. I think that lodged in his mind. And Bannon, later on, when he got to Breitbart News, portrays himself in a political sense, very much like Michael Milken portrayed himself in a financial sense back in the
80s. By the way, right? Of course.
Yes, he went to jail.
People who don't know,
Not a minor footnote in Milken's story. He was busted for insider trading and went to jail for a number of years. But I think Bannon liked the dark outsider narrative that Milken told. And Milken kind of cultivated his own image before he went to jail as this guy who was storming the fortresses and was taking on the fattened, lazy, corrupt establishment, and thereby was doing something good. Bannon did the same thing at Breitbart News. The way he would talk about what he was doing was, we're taking on the establishments of both parties, the crony capitalists. So I think he learned a bit from Milken.
We're going to break and then come back to this story Joshua Green writes about in his book, which is titled Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. We'll be back in a moment.
I can't seem to face up to the facts. I'm tense and nervous and I can't relax. I can't sleep 'cause my bed's on fire. Don't touch me, I'm a real live wire. Psycho killer, qu'est-ce que c'est? Fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa-fa. Better run, 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 run.
Psycho Killer by Talking Heads here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking to Joshua Green, senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek, his new book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon's Donald Trump and the Storming of the Presidency. I want to turn to a speech that Steve Bannon delivered via Skype to a conference held inside the Vatican in 2014.
I believe the world, and particularly the Judeo-Christian West, is in a crisis. And it's really the organized